Welcome to the Think Christian podcast, and happy Halloween. You know why I can say that on a Christian show? Because there's no such thing as secular, even in popular culture. I'm Josh Larson. Yes, I'm a fan of Halloween. My scariest costume, I'm going to say it was the time I dressed up as a blue man from Blue Man Group. Really terrifying, but also blue face paint everywhere. Kind of a nightmare. Halloween has taken over the North American fall calendar the last couple of years. People just can't wait to start decorating their houses with webs and spiders, stocking up on orange-wrapped candy, and of course, watching horror movies. Now, I've long loved fright flicks, which has often put me at odds with some other Christians. Sure, animated films and maybe serious dramas have redemptive value, but horror? Well, on this episode, we're going to offer a defense of horror and even suggest that these movies might actually be in line with the way Christians have been instructed to think about fear. Helping me make that case are two TC writers and fellow horror fans, Abby Olchesi and Joe George. I asked them if they were going to offer a Christian defense of horror, what titles would they choose as an exhibit in their argument? Joe took the opportunity to needle me, picking a classic 1973's The Exorcist that he knows I actually have issues with. Can't wait to hash that out with Joe. I'm always up for a good exorcist debate. Abby went with a more recent choice, 2014's It Follows. That one made my top 10 list that year. So let's start things off with Abby on a positive note. Abby, I'm really glad that you chose It Follows to support your Christian defense of horror. It's a smaller film, an indie that did decent box office, though. It really did resonate with audiences. A lot of people appreciated it, including the two of us. But for those who are unfamiliar, since it is a smaller film and a couple years ago now, maybe can you recap what It Follows is all about and then share a little bit about what you liked about it?
Sure. It Follows tells the story of Jay, played by Micah Monroe, who is college freshman. She's about like 18, 19, and she is dating this guy, Hugh. And so they go out on a date and she decides that she's going to have sex with him. And I believe it's the first time that she's ever done so. She's giving him her virginity. And after they have kind of consummated their relationship, he drugs her and ties her to a chair and informs her that he has now passed to her, kind of like an STD, a demon that will follow her very slowly and consistently. And if she lets it catch up with her, it will kill her. And the only way that she can get rid of this demon is if she passes it to somebody else. And also, if the demon kills her, then it will continue down the line. So it will kill Hugh, and then the person who gave it to him, and then all the way back to its origin. So she now has to figure out how to either kill the demon or pass it on, or just kind of how to survive.
Intense. As you're describing it, yeah, it brings back those opening scenes and yeah, really grabs you right away. It's very much a high concept plot for this sort of horror movie, but also starts immediately raising allegorical questions, I think. You referenced the STD aspect of this, but I think there are some deeper existential implications to this sort of premise as well. So yeah, what grabbed you about this kind of crazy, really creepy movie?
Absolutely. So another thing that I forgot to mention earlier is that the demon can kind of take on the shape of anybody. Could be somebody you know, it could be a total stranger, it could be anything. So you have to really pay attention because also the person who is infected with this demon is the only person who can see it. So there's always the possibility of anybody in the crowd could be this demon, or it could look like somebody who you love, even somebody who's died. And that is something that kind of takes on its own sort of scary, subtle implications much later on in the film. But something that I find really interesting about this movie is that it could be, from the outset, it really sounds like something that gives itself over to gratuity, right? Like a lot of young teenagers having sex with each other, like you might find in like the first Friday the 13th movie, where they're just sort of passing each other this demon so that they don't have to have it anymore. But David Robert Mitchell actually takes a much more existential look at it, where he's more interested in the consequences of becoming an adult. So it's important to note that because Jay is the age that she is, she's moving on from childhood, essentially, into adulthood. She's sort of at this cusp, this changing part of her life where she is recognizing her ultimate mortality. She's moving on to a new stage. And another thing that is interesting is that I feel like this movie addresses exactly what it's going to be about, what kind of movie it's going to be, in a very early scene where she's having a date with Hugh before they get together. And they're in a movie theater and trying to play a game where Jay and Hugh each identify somebody in the crowd that they would like to switch places with. So Jay guesses that Hugh wants to be the guy of this couple that she notices who are making out in the corner. And he says, no, he would much rather be this little boy who's part of a family. He points to them over in another part of the theater because essentially he is sort of in love with the idea of being able to go back and live your life over. So you're switching pretty much immediately from the idea of hormonal teenagers and carnal pleasures to the idea of lost innocence, which I think is a really big theme of the film.
Definitely. Yeah. And that does set the tone. And it does get us to start asking questions beyond the sex equals death genre that, you're right, it has very much been a horror tradition, especially in the 1980s. Those slasher flicks are what come to mind for me. I want to talk a little bit more about that sort of subgenre, but first, just lay the groundwork a little bit for why I wanted to do a show that does defend horror. And specifically films like It Follows. I think for me, it's really rooted into how the Bible handles horror. And so I think about the biblical model is when you look at stories that are horrible from the Bible, often they're about confronting fear rather than suppressing fear. So to confront in order to overcome and maybe to give over those fears to the one who can meet them. So Bible passages that come to mind where we're face-to-face with horror, everything from Cain's bloodlust to Ezekiel's Valley of the Dry Bones, that's a very distinct horror image. And then, of course, you know, there's the despair we see in so many of the Psalms. So when the Bible displays horror in those instances, it's often to expose and name the fears that those things represent. Fear of violence, fear of mortality, you already mentioned that as being an element of It Follows, fear of loneliness in some cases. And then once those fears have been named, they can be seen in the light of God's sovereignty and power and might. So really putting these fears in cosmic context. And what was helpful for me in thinking about all this was a Dietrich Bonhoeffer sermon entitled, actually, Overcoming Fear. This is from 1933, and I wanted to share a little bit of that. So this is Bonhoeffer reflecting on Jesus meeting the disciples' fear when he calmed the storm. Fear is, somehow or other, the archenemy itself. It crouches in people's hearts. It hollows out their insides until their resistance and strength are spent and they suddenly break down. Fear secretly gnaws and eats away at all the ties that bind a person to God and to others. And when, in a time of need, that person reaches for those ties and clings to them, they break, and the individual sinks back into himself or herself, helpless and despairing, while hell rejoices. Now, Bonhoeffer's talking about truly terrible things. His context was Nazi Germany. But I think this applies to even the everyday fears we have, which are often those fears that horror films explore. So I guess my question, Abby, bringing this back to It Follows, is if you see, you mentioned a few themes that bubble to the top for you, but if you see a particular fear that the movie does want to interrogate, what sort of fears are being confronted and maybe through the movie we're trying to wrestle with them when it comes to It Follows?
Sure. I think the film is primarily addressing the eventual fear of death that sort of starts to hit you when you're at a particular age in your life, around the age that Jay is, when you start to realize you're no longer a child but an adult, and kind of recognizing all of the uncertainty and pain and physical decay that kind of come along with those things, and that it can suddenly come from anywhere and it could take any form and you're not entirely sure how to face it because there's really no getting away from it. And I feel like, not to spoil too much, I feel like the movie ultimately resolves it in the idea that you can't escape death, you can't escape mortality, but you can face it with the help of other people. You can kind of watch out for your friends or your family and try to support them, which is a thing that I find kind of ties back into what you were saying, into Bonhoeffer's sermon a little bit, that having faith, having community, having ties around you to hold on to when things get difficult can really help you face that down. The thing that causes that fear may never go away physically, but the way that you react to it and the way that you choose to live with it can and can become a healthier habit.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly you know, suppressing the fear or being in denial of it is not going to bring about any sort of comfort. Because you can't escape it, as you said. And even the title of the film, It Follows, really speaks to that. Whatever that fear may be, the fears are real. So it's not just to brush them away, but to face them rather than suppressing them. You know, often a Christian response to horror films might be, well, that's not a good film to watch. And the subset of that can also be, we don't really want to think about what's being brought up in a movie like that. I think there are certainly some content questions. We've already alluded to them with some of those 80s slasher flicks that are legitimate to ask of horror films. But when buried beneath that, kind of a secondary motive is we really just don't want to talk about death, or we really just don't want to talk about, well, the other fear I want to bring up when it comes to It Follows, and that's sexuality, right? I think this movie has a ton to say about how we should think about sexuality. And that's absolutely a topic that we are fearful about. Everyone, not just Christians, but Christians in particular. And It Follows is so much more sophisticated than those sex equals death films that we've mentioned. You know, they're promiscuous teens. When you think about something like Friday the 13th, promiscuous teens were punished for their sins, right? That was the idea. And we got to watch them behave badly and then get punished. And that's really kind of a dead end exercise, a movie like that. But It Follows is so interesting because it allows Jay to live in the aftermath of the choices she's made in terms of sexuality and wrestle with the implications of it. And in that way, it gives sexuality this metaphysical weight that other horror movies don't always have when they consider this topic. So it recognizes, I think, sexuality's significance to us as created beings in search of meaningful connection, as an opportunity for communion with another soul. It really, it's closer to Christian understanding of sex as a gift in a way from God that we do have a responsibility for. So it's not just this inherently sinful activity that we have to be terrified of, but it is something that we have a responsibility for. And again, to go back to the title of the film, It Follows, I think, alludes to that. You mentioned the director, David Robert Mitchell. The way he uses the camera in this movie is very much influenced by the title. I think it's this slowly advancing camera. You mentioned how the demon appears in these forms. The people we recognize as coming after her, it's not like a race. It's almost more of like the old-fashioned zombie walk, right? They move slowly toward her. And this, again, gives the sense that sexuality is something that has metaphysical weight. It's always with us. It's not something we can deny because we're fearful or uncomfortable with it, but it's something that we really have to wrestle with. So that was maybe my favorite thing about It Follows, which did sound to me like, oh man, is this going to be another sex is death, you know, entry that's pretty empty? And instead, it kind of turned that subgenre on its head for me, which is what I really liked about it. So did you have any other It Follows thoughts, Abby? Otherwise, you know, maybe you could throw out a few other horror titles that came to mind when we talked about doing this episode, A Christian Defense of Horror, other titles you think Christians might really appreciate if they did check out in the horror genre.
Sure. Actually, I wanted to just quickly get back to your thought about the metaphysical weight of sexuality in the film, because I think that's a big part of it. And I think some of the ways that David Robert Mitchell uses the camera, in fact, I think there are a couple of bits early in the film that kind of allude to another famous sex equals death movie, Halloween, where the way that the demon or the creature that is following Jay moves very slowly, much like Michael Myers does. And there are a couple of shots where like a character's head will move and kind of block out our view of a mysterious character. And then the head moves and they're no longer there, which kind of relates to a very specific shot in Halloween. And so in some ways, I almost feel like the movie is kind of a response to Carpenter's film, where I don't necessarily think that he meant to have it be a sex equals death thing. That was just sort of a side effect that got picked up by later films. But that theme is there. And I think David Robert Mitchell's response to it is much more thinking about it in terms of relationship and in terms of metaphorical consequence, which I really like.
Yeah. Oh, there are Halloween influences all over this film. You're right. Even in the score as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Which is part of the fun. Halloween is a movie that I think you're right. There are different levels to it, but that sex equals death element is definitely there. That kind of held me back from really appreciating it, probably as much as I should, but revisited it in the last year or so. And yeah, have come to see it more as this influential film with a lot of credit in its own right, but it's definitely sort of the granddaddy, maybe one of the early entries in that sex equals death genre. Yeah.
For sure. In terms of other horror movies that I think Christians might enjoy or give us more to think about, I think Get Out is kind of an obvious choice. There's a lot of metaphor there and symbolism regarding racial injustice and kind of starting a conversation around that that I feel can have a lot of helpful religious connotations. One of my favorites is the thriller Night of the Hunter, which is a much older film from the 1950s. And I think some people might argue that it may or may not be horror. I think that it is, and I know lots of other film critics in the horror realm who agree. And that, I feel like, has a very direct religious connotation and almost functions as a parable, for me at least, about healthy outward Christianity versus unhealthy outward Christianity, and how the kind that we should aspire to is often much more quiet and servanthood-based than the version that we end up seeing in real life.
Night of the Hunter, yeah, absolute masterpiece, and maybe somewhat forgotten today, so well worth tracking that down. You're right, in plot, it may not sound so much like horror, maybe more thriller, something like that, but when you're watching it, you kind of know you're watching a horror film. I think for some of those underlying elements that you brought up, when those start playing in your head. If listeners want to track down my original post on It Follows from a couple years ago, that is on the TC website, as is a 2015 article I wrote simply titled A Christian Defense of Horror, gets a little bit more into the Bonhoeffer stuff. So just a reminder, if you want to make sure not to miss any of our articles, you can subscribe to receive those via email at thinkchristian.net/subscribe. Abby, before I let you go, any plans to dress up for Halloween this year? Is that something you do, or are you kind of past that point?
I do sometimes. I haven't got my costume planned out yet for this year, but last year I went as Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000, and so I may I may reprise that costume this year.
Wow. A very Thin Christian, deep pop culture reference. I love it. That sounds great. I think, unfortunately, I used to dress up more. Probably my heyday was when my younger daughter, whose birthday was October 1, we used to combine like the class birthday party with Halloween so the kids could all come in their costumes. And then my wife and I would also try to get in some sort of character, but she's outgrown that. So we don't get to play along anymore. She still goes, you know, dresses up and goes out with friends, but we're kind of left behind, sadly. So I'll have to live vicariously through your brilliant costume this year, Abby. Have fun with that. Thanks again for joining us on this episode.
Yeah, thank you.
Boys and girls of every age, wouldn't you like to see something strange?
Come with us and you will see. This is our town of Halloween.
This is Halloween. This is Halloween. Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
This is Halloween. Everybody make a scene.
Trick or treat. Tell the neighbors on the diaphragm.
It's our town. Everybody's free.
Those, of course, were the citizens of Halloween Town regaling us with their village theme song, This is Halloween, from the groundbreaking and oh-so-beautiful 1993 film, The Nightmare Before Christmas. It's hard to believe, but that film is over a quarter century old now, or that we even knew how to celebrate Halloween properly before Jack Skellington and his crew showed us. That song and the rest of that amazing soundtrack was composed and performed by none other than Danny Elfman of Oingo Boingo, and you'll hear one of their songs and a whole lot more musical ruminations of doom, gloom, and things that go bump in the night on this episode's corresponding Spotify playlist. Hi, I'm John J. Thompson, the DJ of this spooky party, and if you know me at all, you know that I have long been a fan of the scary stuff. In fact, the biggest challenge when making this episode's mix was limiting myself. You're still getting a few extras, though. As of now, there are 26 tracks on this haunting mixtape, from acts as diverse as Shovels and Rope, John Mark McMillan, Halsey, Echo and the Bunnymen, Hollywood Vampires, Johnny Cash, Black Sabbath, and Billie Eilish, who you will hear a bit later in this episode. What is it that scares you? Shadows? Stalkers? Risk? Vulnerability? People clapping on 1 in 3? I've always felt that scary stuff makes for great music because the tension is already baked in. And who's not afraid of something these days? There's something about turning our fears into art, especially a song you can sing along to at the top of your lungs, that reduces those boggarts down to a more manageable size. Maybe you'll take this list with you while you go trick-or-treating. Maybe you're hosting a Halloween party and need some music for it. Maybe you just want to play something in your car as you cruise the neighborhood judging your neighbor's lawn decor. Whatever you need, this playlist is ready to howl. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify or find the link in the email you get if you're subscribed to the mailing list and hit play. If you follow the latest episode playlist, the newest one will always be there in your browser, but you can also find each episode's batch listed separately under the Think Christian profile. And of course, we combine all the playlists into one massive archive, so you can follow that as well. And as always, if you think of any songs I should have added, feel free to tweet at me at John J. Thompson, and I will take your suggestions under advisement. That's it for now, but we will be back soon, I hope.
Hi, Think Christian listeners. I'm Wade Beard.
And I'm Kevin McClenathan.
And we just wanted to drop in and let you know about our film and TV podcast, Seeing and Believing.
Every week, we take two movies or television shows, mostly current releases, but sometimes classics. We delve into their narrative and technical aspects and explore their spiritual and religious themes.
To hear us search for the sacred on screen, just hop on over to iTunes and look for Seeing and Believing.
Josh Larson back here with the Think Christian podcast. Whenever I talk to Christians who love horror movies, The Exorcist inevitably comes up, and I'm often on the wrong side of that conversation. Joe George is one of the people on the supposed right side. He loves it as a horror film and as one with particular religious resonance. Me, not so much. You had to pick The Exorcist to talk about, didn't you, Joe?
Now, to be fair, I gave you a list, but I did kind of lead with that one saying, let's please talk about The Exorcist.
Yeah, but, you did allow me a way out, but it was kind of a trap. You knew I couldn't resist.
Oh, totally. Yes. Yeah.
Let's start with the movie itself before we get into how Christians specifically might think about it. Can you remind folks about the details of this 1973 film? I mean, it obviously has a reputation to it, but maybe some people have never actually seen it or it's been a long time. So maybe remind us a little bit about what's going on in The Exorcist. And then just as a horror fan, tell us why this is one of your favorites.
Yeah. Yeah. It is one of those odd movies where even if you've never seen it, you probably know like the head turning bit and the puking green vomit bit and some of the more extreme stuff. What you might not know is that it is very character driven. It's the story of a divorced actress named Chris McNeil, played by Ellen Burstyn, who is raising her daughter, Reagan, played by Linda Blair, by herself. And kind of half the movie tracks the sort of struggles that she has as a single mother trying to do best by her daughter. And it also follows along a priest named Damien Karras, played by Jason Miller. And Father Karras is a psychiatrist in the Catholic Church, a counselor, rather. And he is undergoing a crisis of faith. At the start of the film, he is sort of overwhelmed with the expectations, wants to be transferred out of the church to a different position, struggling to take care of his aging mother. And the two kind of collide when Reagan becomes possessed by a demon. And Chris goes through everything else in the world she can possibly think of to try to cure Reagan. And finally, in a fit of desperation, she turns and asks for an exorcism. And after trying to push it off himself, Father Karras finally agrees, and that leads to sort of the famous scenes. That's the basic plot.
Yeah, and so I think you're totally right. I agree. We can start there, that it is character-driven. If people see this for the first time, they'll probably be almost as shocked by the number of scenes that are paying attention to these characters as to the more notorious ones. So yeah, what makes it special then as a horror film for you?
For a couple of things. One, just on the level of structure. It's gorgeous. The cinematography is gorgeous. I mean, everybody knows the shot of the cover of Max von Sydow's character kind of bathed in light on the outside. And there's plenty of shots like that. It's gorgeous in that way. Judicious in its sound design. As shocking as some of these scenes are, I don't feel like William Friedkin, the director, overplays it. I don't know that he has to, but there's something quiet to the way that it sets up and builds the shocks. And finally, it's character-driven. Again, I keep going back to that. Boy, that's a lame phrase. But you care about these characters, which is not always the case in a horror movie. A lot of times, characters are sort of set up as, I hate these people and I want to see them suffer. Here, we're very invested in their struggles. And so, as a horror fan, it works for me on that level. As a Christian horror fan, It's about a crisis of faith. And yeah. I can think of nothing more scary than that.
Okay, we'll dig a little bit more into that, because that's exactly what people do say to me when the film comes up, is that they find actually special resonance in this film as a Christian, and crisis of faith comes up a lot. So tell me more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've all had struggles like Father Karras where we're done. And the film does a wonderful job of just giving us these scenes of Father Karras just walking down the street and seeing suffering, whether it be a homeless man who says, you know, he's a Catholic, why can't somebody help me? To there's a wonderful shot where he goes to visit his mother in the hospital. And it starts out as this tracking shot of Karras walking down from one end of the room to the other. And as he's walking, various people are coming up to him and grabbing him and pulling on him and asking him for help. He has no strength to give anything to them because he just can't stop thinking about his mother.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been there where we know that we are priests, that we know that we have the message of the good news that we're supposed to carry. And something gets in the way, either our own personal struggles, our own personal failings, or we just don't believe it. And it gives us a character that's in that very relatable situation who cannot get hung up on himself anymore. He has to help this little girl. And isn't, at least that's a fear that I've always had, where when I'm going through my struggles, who is hurting while I'm trying to work out my faith in this way? And is my working out my faith some sort of help, or is it a hindrance? And I can't think of another movie that visualizes that quite so well.
Well, and you're hitting on something that, you know, I argued earlier in this show that is a basic goodness about horror films, is that they do force us to confront fears that otherwise bedevil us. And rather than suppress them, they make us look them in the face and sometimes think about them differently, or at other times give them up to a God who can handle them. And that's particularly tricky when we're talking about a crisis of faith. But yes, I think that's definitely a fear. The fear of losing your faith is a palpable thing in this film. And maybe the difficulty I have with it is because I am so interested in that, and it is so personal for me, that I wanted more of it and a little bit less of those possession scenes that the movie does kind of give itself over to. You mentioned you just rewatched The Exorcist today, and I revisited it last week as well. And I was kind of surprised, I can't say my whole opinion has shifted on it, but I was kind of surprised thinking back on the pretty testy debate I had on the Film Spotting podcast with my co-host Adam Kempinar back in 2013. I was really worked up, more so than I
remember.
Yeah, and I do, you know, I do wonder, just trying to think about that, if it may have been, so about 6 years ago now, my daughter would have been closer to the age of Reagan, played by Linda Blair. And I didn't discuss this on the show, but maybe just seeing some of those possession sequences when, you know, you have a daughter the same age, it just kind of hits you in a more visceral way. I do think the film is exploitative of, you know, Linda Blair and the opportunity of having a child suffer in that way, which maybe I am particularly sensitive to. But I do also think that The Exorcist is exploitative of religious and maybe specifically Catholic tradition and iconography. For me, the elements are there, but they seem to be things, and we should note that this is drawn from William Blatty's novel, The Exorcist. Blatty did the screenplay. And so it seems to be drawn from there by William Friedkin, the director, as just things, signposts that maybe had to be included to get him to some of the other stuff that the movie is more interested in. Some of it is that character stuff, which is good, but a lot of it for me really is the over-the-top vileness of the possession scenes. And you mentioned how you don't think he overplays it. I don't know how many times you've seen The Exorcist now, Joe, but it's still a lot. I think I've seen it probably 4 times. And just the graphic nature, and I think there's one filmmaking craft thing, the levitation moment, when she does rise from the bed. And watching it again, for me, that was the only effective filmmaking element of those possession scenes that held up, because it was quieter, it was unexpected, and it was, for some reason, more disturbing to me than a lot of the shock stuff that the movie does kind of give itself over to. So I don't know why that seemed like an effective touch for me, that levitation moment.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is effective precisely for what you say, that it's, I mean, you're right. I am calling a part where a scene where a character pukes up green goo is like, eh, he's not overplaying it. That's all right.
A lot of green goo.
Yeah, there's a lot of green goo in this movie. And you're right. The levitation scene is more quiet. It kind of comes out of nowhere. I love that scene as well.
It's probably one of the more iconic images, you could say, too, from the film that lasts. The lighting, you mentioned the cinematography, the lighting just kind of bringing this otherworldly sense to this otherwise fairly familiar bedroom. And I guess that's another thing we can maybe talk about is how you feel the movie literalizes spiritual struggle. Because it just kind of, for me, it raises the issue. There's a very early scene where Karis is with another priest in a bar and he just tells him, I've lost my faith. And suddenly we cut short to something else. It's like, okay, we're going to put this in here, but it's not really what I'm interested in. And then it comes back where it's the essential struggle in those possession scenes, which for me, it doesn't seem like it's really digging into what that sort of spiritual struggle might be like. But obviously it works differently for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I read that scene totally different. So yeah, there's a scene early on, Karis is talking to Father Dyer and it's exactly like you say, they're in a bar, they're talking. And he just says, I lost my faith. And it's a hard cut. Like yeah. As soon as he says that, it cuts hard back to the Ray McNeil household. And we get this argument that Chris McNeil is having with a representative for her ex-husband. And she's trying to get the husband to get on the phone to call her daughter on her birthday. Right. And it's this one shot that slowly pulls out from Chris in the one bedroom and pulls out through the hallway, and we see Reagan sitting around the corner, forlorn, and then she goes and throws herself on the bed while we hear her mother kind of curse out this person. The reason that Karis loses his faith, I think, is important because there's a lot of indications of the sort of suffering in the world, just vague sort of suffering. It has nothing to do, he doesn't even believe in exorcism by the time that Chris comes to talk to him about it. So he's not even thinking on terms of spiritual warfare. He's just thinking of, the world is awful. And as somebody who's supposed to have an answer for it, I don't anymore. And I take that as just an example of why he's lost his faith. Because look, we've got a modern equivalent to the fatherless and the widow here. Nobody's helping her. She's lost. She's stranded. And that's exactly the sort of stuff that makes him lose his faith. By the time we get to the more extreme stuff that you're pointing out, I don't read that as exploitative of Christianity or Catholicism or anything like that. Rather, for me, it literalizes, in an out there way, literalizes what that struggle's like. During the exorcism, we have all these crazy things that are happening. You know, the girl is shouting these horrid, foul things. The room is shaking. The walls are quaking. You know, it's very in your face. And Karis, the one who's struggling, keeps losing attention. And Father Marin, played by Max von Sydow, keeps telling him, pay attention. And he keeps reciting scripture. You know, it's staged as like a conflict, as a battle in big movie ways. But isn't that kind of, at least for me, that's what my spiritual struggle looks like, where I'm getting distracted by the evil in the world, by whatever the voice is telling me I'm not good enough or anything like that. And I need to be drawn back to Psalm 54, which they quote during that scene, and need to understand, you know, we're made in the image of God. It's the power of Christ that compels us to do these things. It visualizes that in large, bold ways, but I think that struggle's real. I see it.
Yeah, and in a way, you know, the film can trace Karis's return to faith through these very dramatic experiences, right? Don't want to spoil it, but it goes in a tragic direction, but he does seem to make a return to faith by experiencing this. Maybe it can be read as well of an embracing of faith on the part of Chris McNeil. Doesn't seem to be a part of her life previous to this experience. And for Reagan, too, I mean, one of the final shots is of her giving another priest an unexpected kiss before she leaves. So there are hints of, you know, this spiritual journey that not just Karis, but a number of the characters do take throughout the film. And maybe interestingly, here's another thing I wanted to throw at you, because I thought about it watching it again. Maybe interestingly, in opposition to science, as you mentioned, Chris McNeil subjects almost as horrific are some of those early medical testing scenes when they're trying to figure out what Reagan might be suffering from. And I think that's purposeful that Friedkin is making those as uncomfortable as well. But it is the doctors eventually, interestingly, who say, hey, we're out of answers here. We're out of things we can try. Have you heard of exorcisms? And, you know, that to me was just interesting. In the light of 2019, thinking about this movie coming out in 73, right? where it's only become more of an issue, I think, for Christians to deny science and be skeptical of science. I mean, from everything from vaccinations to climate change, that's something that in some circles of the Christian faith, there's a skepticism towards science. And so, I don't know, is there anything exploitative going on here by kind of the movie feasting on that, you know, that science isn't going to be able to help you. You know that because we're going to go into this other more elaborate and really kind of showy movie world that I'm going to bring you into.
Yeah, I can see that reading. And it's hard to disagree that those scenes are, I mean, the shot of the blood spurting out of Reagan's neck as they put the whatchamacallit in there. It's a rough shot. Yeah. And he's definitely playing that up. Again, I tend to read a little bit more generously that we're seeing a world that wants to believe in anything other than the spiritual elements
okay.
and are desperate and want to forget it. And there's a horror that goes in that direction as well. That's how I tend to read that. But I can definitely see your, it's gross.
Yeah, no, but there's,
he wants it to be gross.
And the horror connection is definitely intentional and is definitely there. Whenever a movie has this much of a reputation and sticks around this long, it's working on audiences in very intentional ways. And so it's always fun to kind of return to these and ask, you know, why does this still stick around? Why do people wrestle with this movie and struggle with it? So I'm glad we could revisit The Exorcist. Is there anything else you think we should touch on before we move on?
I mean, I didn't hear you admit that it's a great movie and you've changed your mind. That's the only thing I need out of this conversation.
I came maybe a little closer.
Okay.
I did
okay.
notice, you know, there are those two scenes of Karis leading mass. And
yeah.
those stood out to me this time. Again, if I'm skeptical of how much Friedkin is interested in the religious element, and I still remain skeptical that that's primarily what the movie's interested in, it is telling that he does make the space for those two sequences where you can see Karis struggling, even as he's still going, to your point, as he knows he's the person in position to hold the good news, and leading mass is his chance to share that. But you also see the struggle on his face. If I don't believe this, how can I be in this position? And Jason Miller, I think, you know, is just fantastic in this part. You can read everything going on in that tortured face. Maybe on a movie element, why I'm a little more standoffish is I don't know that Ellen Burstyn is quite as modulated as maybe the movie should have. You're a fan of Burstyn too, I take it. Okay.
When I watch Stranger Things, I point out Winona Ryder's performance and I say, this is the bad version of the Chris McNeil.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Winona Ryder is having a lot of fun in Stranger Things. I take your point. All right. Well, thanks for putting up with my pessimism, Joe. Maybe before you go, any other horror titles? Remind me the other ones on your list that you did suggest Christians might really get something out of by exploring this Halloween season.
Yeah. One that I threw out there is The Witch, which is another very difficult one.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you'll know within 10 minutes if this is a movie for you, but I think that there's a lot there to chew on thinking about Satan as an accuser and the way that accusations and guilt play out. I think that's where the horror happens in that one. Poltergeist, I think, is a great one to check out. Perhaps a slightly more family-friendly one. You might go back to the classics, the Dracula, Wolfman, and the James Whale's Frankenstein movies are both great. And all of those kind of deal with questions about our morality, our external goodness being corrupted by our internal true natures. So you really can't go wrong. Any sort of scary movie, there's substance there. And I would encourage Christians, I'm sure you and Abby talked about this, but whenever you watch, just ask, what scares me? What's the thing that's scaring me here? And then try to interrogate that prayerfully and intellectually.
Very good advice. Good titles there, too. I did write about The Witch on the TC website, so listeners can check that out. And there's a fair number of horror films we've written about on the site, including plenty by you, Joe. So if you're still interested in learning more about this topic, other films, other TV shows we've written about, go ahead and check out thinkchristian.net. Thanks so much, Joe. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Josh.
All the good girls go to hell. 'Cause even God herself has enemies, and once the water starts to rise and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team. My Lucifer is lonely.
Who's afraid of Billie Eilish? That's what Chris Wheeler asked in his TC post about the teen goth pop star who seems to have modeled her persona partly on poor, possessed Linda Blair in The Exorcist. You just heard Eilish's All the Good Girls Go to Hell from her 2019 album When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Here's Chris writing about her music. Rather than run, Billie Eilish is here to embody the fear and in the process interrogate it. That seems very appropriate for this show. Thanks to Abby Olchesi and Joe George for helping me to interrogate some fears, including the fear some Christians have of horror movies. You can follow them both on Twitter. Abby is at Abby Olchesi. That's ABBYOLCESE. And Joe is J.A. George II at JAGEORGEII. I'm at Larson on Film, and you can also follow us at Think Christian. That Halloween party playlist featuring Billie Eilish and the citizens of Halloween Town, along with plenty of others, that's waiting for you on Spotify, courtesy of John J. Thompson. Find it by searching for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. We've been plugging our newest ebook on the last few episodes, A Theology of the Office, and the feedback so far has been great. Joe George actually contributed one of the essays, Let Scott's Tots Come Unto Me. You don't want to miss out on this, so go to thinkchristian.net/theoffice. That's where you can get your free copy. And please do spread the word to any friends you know who are Office fans. However you help, TC, thanks for joining us to consider how our pop culture fandom resonates with our faith. If you have thoughts about this episode or the show in general, you can always leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us as well. But you can also get in touch with me directly. I'm Josh Larson. My email is jlarson@reframemedia.com. That's J-L-A-R-S-E-N. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder. Lastly, a note of thanks to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois, which provided the recording space for this episode. Learn more at trnty.edu. And go Trolls.